these poor Black and Latino neighborhoods have been neglected by the government, by New York State, as well as their neighborhoods have been sold out. Gentrification throughout New York City is specifically targeting neighborhoods in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx.
Cuomo also announced he was going to sign legislation that allows for civil lawsuits against gun manufacturers, distributors, and dealers for how they market and sell firearms. The governor added that over the 4th of July weekend, at least 51 people fell victim to gun violence across the U.S. state alone. U.S. President Joe Biden announced last month his plan to fight the rising gun crimes across the country.
Today, the department is announcing, as I just did, a major crackdown on stem the flow of guns used to commit violent crimes. It's zero tolerance for gun dealers who willfully violate key existing laws and regulations. Let me repeat, zero tolerance.
His plan includes allocating more funds to law enforcement agencies to improve their ability to track and disrupt gun trafficking. He's set to meet with the country's law enforcement, local elected officials, and advocates to discuss the plan on Monday. The White House says the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package provides funding not only to the police, but also to programs such as youth employment, which can help reduce crime rates. The Democrats and Republicans are now pointing fingers at each other over soaring gun violence, with the GOPs criticizing Biden's performance in fighting crimes and Democrats blaming their political rivals for blocking their proposals on gun control.
The American obsession with guns at its root is because our founding fathers and the right have just made it part of the American identity, make it seem as if to be American is to own a gun, when being American is so much more than that. It's about working hard and defending your neighbor and, you know, wanting better for yourselves.
An FBI report in March pointed to a 25% increase in the number of homicide cases in 2020 compared to a year before. Figures suggest the rising trend has continued into 2021, fueling concerns that the U.S. could witness one of its highest numbers of homicides it has ever recorded this year.
Lebanon is just days away from a social explosion. The stark warning has been made by Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab, who has called on the international community to help the country avoid an all-out economic and social crisis. According to the World Bank, Lebanon is now experiencing one of the worst economic depressions in modern history. Diab has been serving in a caretaker capacity since resigning in the wake of the catastrophic August 4 Beirut port explosion. More than 200 people were killed and over 6,000 others injured in the giant blast. Dozens of people are still unaccounted for. Since then, politicians have been unable to agree on a new government. I appeal through you to the kings, princes, presidents, and leaders of brotherly and friendly countries. And I call upon the United Nations and all international bodies, the international community, and the global public opinion to help save the Lebanese from death and prevent the demise of Lebanon. Diab has urged friendly nations to help Lebanon despite the lack of a new government. He said only a new cabinet could restart talks with the International Monetary Fund so that the country may get out of its deepening crisis.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
Amid the political standoff, occasional unrest marked by attacks on government buildings, and the torching of banks and financial institutions by certain elements has sparked warnings of what's to come. Lebanon is now on the brink of total collapse. Anger over fuel shortages has spilled into fights at petrol stations since the country is short of fuel. The national currency has now lost more than 90% of its value since October 2019. The country's gross domestic product dropped from close to $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated $33 billion last year. GDP per capita also plummeted by around 40%. The nation's unemployment rate spiked from 28% in February 2020 to nearly 40% by the end of the year.
It's because the whole economic crisis is manufactured. The central bank manager is controlled by the United States, and all the banks have also loyalty to the United States. And so over the last 2.5 years, these banks moved out close to $60 billion out of the country, which crashed the lira. And now all that money is in Switzerland. Nobody's being held responsible.
The crisis has worsened, with the central bank cutting back on financing imports with subsidized dollars. The crisis is mostly linked to the sanctions that the U.S. and its allies have imposed on Lebanon, as well as foreign intervention in the Arab nation's domestic affairs.
While the United States has been trying for more than 15 years, and even more than that, to corner Hezbollah in Lebanon and get the population to rise up against it. It didn't work in 2006 in the war directly with apartheid Israel.
Over 250 of Washington's sanctions targets are in Lebanon or related to the country, and this number has been growing quickly. U.S. sanctions have seriously undermined the stability of the banking sector by reducing the inflow of foreign capital.
So the purposeful crashing of the economy and making life harder for Lebanese people, the United States is hoping that the population in Lebanon would rise up against Hezbollah. And as we've heard from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah will try its best to make sure that this plan doesn't work.
Saudi Arabia has also imposed its own sanctions, including banning its citizens from traveling to Lebanon, where Riyadh-backed elements have been jockeying for position.
Iran has been a major victim of terrorism over the past decades, with over 17,000 Iranians losing their lives in terrorist attacks. Iran has long criticized Western states, especially the United States, for employing double standards in dealing with terrorism. The West's support for anti-Iran terrorist group Mujahideen-e Khalq organization, also known as the MKO, is a case in point. The notorious Mujahideen-e Khalq organization is responsible for the killing of about 12,000 Iranian people and officials since the Islamic Revolution of 1979. The group has carried out bombings and assassinations across Iran. The MKO is a well-known enemy of the Iranian nation with a horrific record that is known to all countries in the region and beyond. During the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, the MKO joined forces with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein to carry out cross-border attacks. They also helped the former Iraqi dictator to crack down on dissent at home. After the war, MKO members spent many years in a camp in Iraq's Diyala province before being relocated to Albania in 2016. The cult-like group does not tolerate any form of dissent within the organization. Former MKO members who managed to leave the group have painted a grim picture of how the organization treats its members, especially those who intend to leave the MKO. They have reported abuses ranging from solitary confinements to severe beatings and torture. Over the past years, MKO summits have been attended by hawkish U.S. politicians such as former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich. The U.S. politicians are said to have received hefty sums to attend MKO summits and back the group's calls for regime change in Iran. Observers believe the American and European stances regarding the MKO have exposed their double standards in dealing with terrorism.
When they say that they want to fight terrorist organizations, what they mean is they want to fight every sort of organization that is in any way an obstacle in the further benefit of Western hegemony. We have seen the term terrorism being used over and over and over again to assign any and every sort of organization, even the ones that are not even violent, any sort of organization that opposes imperialism.
The Mujahideen Khalq organization was on the U.S. list of terrorist groups for 15 years, but then removed in 2012 to pave the way for the MKO to receive funds more easily. Iran says lobbies in the United States were heavily bribed that year to facilitate the controversial removal. Major European countries, including France, also removed it from their blacklists. Top MKO members, including its public face, Maryam Rajavi, have been moving closer to hawkish U.S. politicians. The deepening ties between U.S. and European governments and Mujahideen Khalq terror group suggests that the West may be trying to use the MKO to pressure Iran.
It is not surprising, unfortunately, to see such a close collusion between the MKO and the United States of America. We have seen this happen for the past 30, 40 years. And this has become very clear a couple of years ago, of course, when they held a massive rally in which they invited people such as John Bolton and Rudy Giuliani, some of the most imperialist war hawks that the United States has ever known in the past, let's say, century. So when they attend meetings of the MKO and when they speak there of what they consider the need for, quote-unquote, spreading democracy to Iran, this is what they are trying to achieve. The resurgence of U.S. imperialist control.
How can Western states be supporting this notorious terrorist group and at the same time accuse other countries of backing terrorism?
In the limelight. The disproportionate impact of COVID-19 had on low-income and non-white Americans, populations that community colleges tend to serve, created a plunge in community college attendance during the pandemic. We now present you an article written by Lauren Aratani under the heading U.S. community colleges see chilling decline in enrollment during pandemic. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. David Ramirez, a student at Pasadena City College in Pasadena, California, struggled with balancing work and classes during the pandemic. David Ramirez, who works at Starbucks, worked at least 30 hours a week in addition to his classes. He wasn't alone. According to the National Student Clearinghouse data released recently, the number of students enrolled in community colleges, local educational establishments that offer two-year courses that are often seen as an affordable stepping stone to higher education, was down 9.5% this past spring, about 476,000 fewer students than in spring of 2020. The fall has experts worried about the long-term impact of the pandemic on the less well-off. During recessions, enrollment at community colleges tends to increase, as those who become unemployed go back to education. But the disproportionate impact COVID-19 had on low-income and non-white Americans, populations that community colleges tend to serve, created a plunge in community college attendance during the pandemic. David Ramirez said, "I didn't really have the option to stay virtual and work from home, so I essentially exposed to this virus every single day. That was a lot to handle on a day-to-day basis and then go home and try to work on schoolwork." He added, "That's the daily experience for students, especially because financial aid for community college doesn't really cover the full cost of attendance." Online classes, especially for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics subjects, were particularly frustrating to manage, as the material was difficult to learn virtually. He said, "I imagine a lot of students simply gave up." While overall college attendance dropped 5% or 727,000 students this spring compared with last year, as many students opted out of virtual learning, community colleges saw the steepest declines when compared to four-year institutions and graduate schools. Enrollment at graduate schools actually increased 4.6% compared with last year. The bulk of enrollment drops at community colleges were seen by schools' younger students, aged between 18 and 24. Separate data from the National Student Clearinghouse has shown a 6.8% decline in graduates of the class of 2020 who attended college immediately after high school, compared to the class of 2019. This means while students with undergraduate degrees were getting advanced degrees in high numbers, many high school graduates chose not to attend college at all this year. Davis Jenkins, a senior research scholar and research professor at Columbia's Teachers College, said the decline in college enrollment among graduating high school students is chilling. Davis Jenkins said, "Delaying college really diminishes your chance of completing college," adding, "particularly if community college enrollment is declining. You take away the opportunity of college for millions of students." Jenkins noted, "It's going to increase the divide between education have and have-nots. Community college students make up about 40% of all undergraduate students in the country, totaling 8.2 million across over 1,400 community colleges, the majority of which are public institutions. Many students who opt to attend community college over a four-year institution do so because tuition can be thousands of dollars cheaper. Two-thirds of community college students come from families with household incomes of under $50,000 a year, and about 45% are students of color. Low-income Americans were hardest hit by the economic repercussions of COVID-19 compared to middle and high-income Americans, being more likely to lose their jobs and remain unemployed during the course of the coronavirus pandemic. The toll of the pandemic also disproportionately hits Black and Hispanic Americans, who saw COVID death rates that were at least two times higher than white Americans. In a survey of about 25,000 students, community college students were more likely to cancel all plans for college compared to students enrolled at four-year colleges. They were also more likely to have caught, be concerned about, or care for someone who had the virus, and be concerned about the affordability of college. Administrators at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, Ohio, heard similar concerns from students who were busy caring for family or working and did not see the benefit of attending virtual classes. The school saw a 17% decline in enrollment this past school year. Karen Miller, provost and executive vice president of Access, Learning and Success at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, Ohio, said, "They were definitely affected by this, whether it be a family member who might have contracted COVID or somebody in their family lost a job and they had to go to work instead of coming to school. Some students were concerned about inconsistent Wi-Fi or a lack of quiet spaces to study at home." Karen Miller said the community college had started efforts to get students to re-enroll in the fall, calling, emailing, and texting them to let them know that the school will be back with at least 50% of the in-person capacity. Karen Miller said, "We're trying to re-engage them and let them know that we're going to have an on-ground opportunities, more on-ground classes, and open up our service footprint again come August." She added, "We're hopeful that we're going to see students come back this fall."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth
Station.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon you all, and you're listening to Youth Station, only on IRIB English Radio.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
I'm your host, Hassanain, and we have in our
Zainab,
studio...
Zainab, salamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum salam. How are you, sister Zainab?
I thought I would like, you know.
How are you?
I'm good, alhamdulillah. I'm good. You know what? I don't think there is anything you could be too old for. Except like maybe drinking milk out of a bottle.
What about like, you know, playing with clay, playing with toys and
no.
all?
No.
Okay, when's the last time you played with toys?
Our last time was this weekend.
Okay, so do you think there should be any age so that, you know, you cannot play after this age? Like,
no.
You're too old for
why
that?
Why should... No, first tell me why should there be.
According to people, it's not appropriate for your age to be playing with toys.
Who defines that appropriateness?
Society, maybe?
Well, is society an expert on things which are appropriate for age? Yes.
Nah, they have just random thoughts.
People with random thoughts.
Upon the people.
Exactly. I mean, like, when it comes down to certain things, yeah. I really feel... Okay. All right. Let me get this right. I really feel that society doesn't know what it's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because if one single person says something wrong,
mm-hmm.
does it make it right? Like one person that you know well.
Yeah.
Says something wrong. So why would 500 people saying something wrong make it right? Right? That's what the society is. I'm not saying everything the society says is wrong, right? But if they don't know what they're talking about, then they're wrong.
Hey, wait. I remember one thing. Let me share this. So once there was one man, he was reciting Salatul Janazah.
Yeah.
For a man. And, you know, like, there were 40 men standing behind him.
Yep.
And they were praying with him.
Mm-mm.
So a man was passing by, and he saw that the man whom they're praying the janazah for is still alive. He's in his coffin, and he's, you know, he's shouting, like, he's crying. I'm alive, I'm alive. So, like, the man went and asked the, you know, the man who was leading the prayer, "Wait, what are you doing? He's still alive." It's like, this one man He's claiming to be alive, and these 40 men, they're claiming him to be dead.
Exactly.
Whom should I listen to?
Yeah. Sometimes society doesn't know what the hell it's talking about.
Right.
Sure, there's a concept within Islam and within fiqh called urf, right?
Right.
The norm. And by norm, they don't mean...
Every norm.
Like, there are certain cultures that are norms of a society, but they're just downright wrong. When Rasulullah began preaching people to Islam in the Arabic Peninsula, it was the norm for them to worship idols, to have slaves and torture their slaves and abuse their slaves.
Mm-hmm.
It was their norm to bury their baby girls.
And you simply cannot follow that.
And he was like, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
Y'all got to be changing your norms.
Right.
Right? So I'm saying that sometimes there's norms in society. So what Islam in our fiqh, in our jurisprudence, we talk about urf. We mean the urf among people with knowledge.
Right.
A bunch of experts would say that this is muta'arif to us. This is acceptable for us.
Right.
Right? Not just every Tom, Dick, and Harry come and say that, yeah, well, I don't think you should be playing with this toy anymore because you're too old.
Right.
Well, you look stupid in that hat, Tom, but I don't. You don't see me calling you out for that. The point is...
Mm-hmm.
What was the point? Ah, the point is you're never too old for... There are certain things... You're almost never too old for anything. Like, age is definitely just a number.
Okay, so what about, you know, people... Let's talk about marriage.
What about marriage?
Like, if someone gets married at, like, maybe a boy gets married at 20, at the age of 20.
Yep.
People might say, hey, you're too young for marriage. And, like, if he gets married at 30, people say, you're too old
for marriage. Dude, like, if he loves her, he loves her. If he has the right mentality. See, I think it has all, you know, the hadith that says, al-amal bin-niyat.
Mm-hmm.
Every deed depends on the intention behind it.
Yeah.
If a person has the proper mindset when they enter a marriage, it doesn't matter whether they're 16, 25, 35, 65. A person might find love at the age of 65.
Right.
Are you telling me Allah is going to deprive his servant of that rizq after a certain age? It don't make sense.
Right?
In the immortal words of my niece, it makes no sense. If they enter something with the correct mentality and with the intention to serve a correct purpose, it doesn't matter what age. A person can get their PhD at the age of 52. And you've seen people do that.
But you see, it's always a society deciding, like, when you have to get married, when you have to get your kids.
Well, society's wrong. That's what I'm saying. We should rebel against society. I'm just saying that people should educate themselves. And because...
Okay, so are you saying that there should come a point where for the so-and-so person, the thoughts of the society...
Shouldn't matter anymore?
Shouldn't matter anymore.
Yeah. Do the thoughts of the society matter to you?
Not really.
When you go back home... Okay, here you're a foreigner. You're considered as a foreigner in Iran. But when you go back home, do you think that... what society thinks of you matters?
If I'm on the right path, like, it doesn't really matter to me.
How do you know you're on the right path?
What Allah thinks that matters.
That's what I wanted to say too. Because opinions and the norms and what's considered as appropriate constantly changes from one society to the other. But only Allah is, and his rule and his norms and his tradition are stable. And nowhere in the words of Allah or the Ahlul Bayt we see them saying that you're too old for this.
Right.
Is it too old for a person to convert to Islam or revert to Islam?
No.
We have so much of the followers or the ashab of Rasulullah, his companions, that reverted back to into Islam at an old age.
Yeah. Wait, Sister Zain, what do you think? Like, people should start living for Allah instead of, you know, living for Abdullah.
Obviously, for the servant of Allah. Obviously, people should... And once you live like that, you feel like... Really, you feel like age is just a number.
Yeah.
You know, like, even in the Quran, we have examples of it, where Nabi Zakaria ala Nabina Walu alayhi salam, or Nabi Ibrahim ala Nabina Walu alayhi salam. How old were they when Allah gave them their first son?
Right. I actually think this
really
society
darn old.
And this peer pressure... It's not a good thing.
Yeah, don't rush people. Yeah. They're ready when they're ready. Don't be rushing them. Oh, when are you getting married? Oh, when are you going to have your kid? What, your baby?
Yeah.
Oh, and I feel like in a lot of like Middle Eastern countries, mm-hmm. people have not reached the intellectual capacity
mm-hmm.
not to discuss these private personal matters yeah. with others yet. Oh, when are you getting married? When are you going to get your degree? When are you going to have your baby? Mm-hmm. When are you going to buy a house? Oh, you're getting too old. It's like, I feel like I want to tell that person, have you seen yourself in the mirror? You're old. You don't see me asking you when you're going to die. I'll do it when I do it. I'll do it when I'm ready. Yeah. I'll do it. In fact, I'll do it when Allah wants me to do it. Except. If I don't have a child now, if I don't have a spouse now, if I don't have a house now, if I haven't gotten my doctorates now, it's because yeah. Allah hasn't willed it for me yet. So back off.
Right.
Age has nothing to do with it.
Like, people should like seriously start thinking this way, that it shouldn't matter what people think about me. It matters what Allah thinks about me, and I should do what Allah wants from me.
Exactly.
Please stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back to your audience, and where we were discussing about, you know, people being too young to do something.
Or too old. Is too age old.
A... Yeah, is age a limit? Does it matter, like, to do, if you want to do something? Does age really matter?
Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, when you're playing with children or when you're talking to children, be a child. Are we ever going to say that, oh, but I'm too old for this? Look, some people, they don't get along with children, right? And that's their prerogative, it's their personality, it's their preference, and it's fine. We're not going to force people to play yeah. with kids. But once you do, you got to, like, forget the fact that you're 25 or mm-hmm. 35 or 45 right. or a 75-year-old grandpa
right.
and be a kid all over again, the way Rasulullah was. Mm-hmm. If we're going to say certain acts are immature,
right.
that certain acts really are immature,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think by that, by immature, what we really mean, even as a society, is that a person does not fulfill the responsibilities that their age entails.
Right.
Right? And that's natural. That's a natural process of life.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Mother Nature puts us through this journey mm-hmm. where we develop at each stage.
Right.
And in each stage, Mother Nature bestows us with a new set of skills. And with each set of skills comes new responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And if a person fails their responsibilities and doesn't try to fulfill them, we call them immature.
Because
mm-hmm. you didn't live up to the responsibilities that stage of your journey entails.
Right.
Right? But then on the other hand, we see Rasulullah himself, when he was playing with his grandkids, he would mm-hmm. give them piggyback rides.
So it's not like being too old for doing something.
Exactly. In fact, at that stage of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam's life, it was his responsibility to goof around with his grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually the most mature, fitting thing he could do for his age. You know, my point is, don't let people tell you that you're too old for this, you're too old for that.
Right.
Oh, but sometimes you are too young, though.
Like, we can start with...
You're too young to vote. Don't argue with me.
Yeah, I know. Because, there's certain circumstances, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's not aware of the politics. He's not aware of the leaders. He's not aware of the
You're not
leaders.
Equipped yet. We talked about how Mother Nature equips us with certain skills.
Like, maybe it might be driving.
Yeah.
It might be voting.
The wiring of your brain is not complete yet for you to take on a certain task.
Right.
But once you reach an age where your brain is completely developed, and I think it's the age of 25 or something, then you're just... You know, it's a matter of the choices you make and the intentions you put behind it.
You might be too young for certain things, right?
Yeah.
Like, the vice versa is like being too old to do something.
But we established
We've already discussed
something.
About it. Yeah, and being too young, like driving.
Sure, if you're like a genius, a child protege, certain things. But those
are exceptions, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And you could be, like, mentally impaired. You could be retarded. And mm-hmm. you, no matter how old you get, you still can't do certain things. So it works both ways, and when you're an exception. But at the end of the day, I think we're going to conclude this discussion that age is definitely just a number. We have examples of it in the Quran, in Ahadith. Mm-hmm. It's never too late to do what you want to do to better yourself and your life.
And we have mujtahideen who became mujtahid at the age of like 9, 10, 15, like that.
Or like 35.
Yeah. Or so like 70.
70, you know? Yeah, that's it.
That's all the time we have for today, and thanks so much, dear audience. You were listening to Youth Station. Until the next program, fi amanullah.
My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my alpha and omega, my protector and my because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker, abiding in silence with patience and guidance, the well when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love, is strong.
In the limelight.
Rumsfeld never had much understanding of Iraq or Afghanistan, and probably did not think that he had any need to do so, says Patrick Cockburn Ryder in an article published under the heading, Rumsfeld was a living symbol of America's plunge into quagmire. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. As U.S. War Secretary between 2001 and 2006, Rumsfeld gloried in his role as America's military chief, avenging 9/11. But his arrogance and inability to adjust to the realities of the Afghan and Iraq wars produced frustration or failure on the battlefield. Maneuver, though, Rumsfeld did to avoid responsibility for the Iraq war. He became the living symbol of America's plunge into the quagmire. Typically, he responded to this by banning his staff at the Pentagon from using the word quagmire along with resistance and insurgents. Rumsfeld started his career as a Republican congressman from Illinois and moved on to serve four Republican presidents. He headed the Office for Economic Opportunity under Nixon, became War Secretary and Ambassador to NATO in the Ford administration. As President Ronald Reagan's special envoy to the West Asia North Africa region, he traveled to Baghdad to shake hands with Saddam Hussein and assure him of U.S. support in the eight-year war that the Iraqi dictator had imposed against Iran. Rumsfeld's camaraderie with Saddam reflected American strategy at the time, but it also showed Rumsfeld's liking for people with power and his dismissiveness towards those without it. It was Iraq that turned out to be his nemesis. He promoted his public image as the man who did not blinch when Al-Qaeda flew a plane into the Pentagon on 9/11. He had personally rushed to succor survivors, though witnesses later said stories of his heroism were exaggerated. By that evening, he was giving a press conference from a bunker in the Pentagon, demonstrating that though President George W. Bush might have been evacuated to safety, his war secretary was standing tall. Within hours of the Al-Qaeda attack, Rumsfeld was looking to use it as justification for a war against Iraq. He sent a note to General Richard Myers, vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, looking for best info fast, judge whether good enough to hit Saddam Hussein, at the same time, not only Osama bin Laden. This detail, along with much else in this piece, is derived from Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy by Andrew Cockburn. Rumsfeld sought, in his memoir, to evade responsibility for launching the Iraq War, claiming that President Bush had never asked him if he was in favor of it. The excuse is absurd, since the war secretary had constant one-on-one meetings with Bush, who might well assume that the man in charge of gathering America's armies for the invasion was in favor of doing so. Rumsfeld enjoyed flying around the world in his giant C-17 transport plane, addressing assemblies of U.S. troops, but he was essentially a palace politician. Not only did he have access to the Oval Office himself, but he fought determined campaigns to exclude other top officials from meetings with the president. He was even upset when Jerry Bremer, the newly appointed U.S. Viceroy in Iraq, had a private lunch with Bush in May 2003. Rumsfeld never had much understanding of Iraq or Afghanistan and probably did not think that he had any need to do so because the military might of the U.S. appeared overwhelming. Rumsfeld reacted furiously when the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Eric Shinseki, told the Senate hearing that several hundred thousand troops might be needed as an occupation force after the invasion. Rumsfeld's pretense that he did not favor the Iraqi war is easily disproved, but a better line of defense from his point of view was that almost no members of America's political military elite were opposed to the war at the time. Critics countered this by saying that military officers whose promotion was in the hands of Rumsfeld were unlikely to express skepticism about his plans. Rumsfeld produced a much-quoted but fallacious explanation, which was used to explain why the U.S. was so often caught by surprise by disastrous events in Iraq. He said that some facts were known and others unknown facts. But there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know, we don't know. Rumsfeld said this in 2002 in relation to the shortage of evidence for the presence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and it briefly won him a reputation for intellectual brilliance, but it masked the damning fact that there were no knowns about Iraq that were good reasons for believing that a regime change would lead to a prolonged military and political crisis.
a diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. The jihadi movement in the judiciary branch, initiated by Hujjatul Islam Raisi, has earned the people's trust. Well, it is necessary to thank Mr. Raisi as the judiciary branch is undergoing a transformation. During the 2+ years that he was in charge of the judiciary, he really worked hard and good things were done in that branch. And Mr. Raisi's move in the judiciary was an example of what we always repeat, jihadi movement. Jihadi movement means a serious, round-the-clock, hard-working and motivated movement. The movement launched by him was like this and thankfully, it has had good results. The most important effect of this movement was that it revived the people's hope for the judiciary and it made the people optimistic about the judiciary. We receive people's complaints from various organizations. There is a lot of difference in the people's opinion before and after these 2+ years. His services revived hope and confidence in the branch. This is social capital. The people's trust in the active apparatus in the Islamic Republic is a great social capital and there is nothing equivalent to it. Thankfully, the judiciary branch has accomplished this feat.
Subhanallah, alhamdulillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah.
The necessity to continue the transformation movement in the judiciary branch. Well, now that the judiciary is undergoing a new change, I have to make a few points that, God willing, will be taken into consideration in the future of the judiciary movement. These are exactly the things he just said, and I have written them down as well. First, there is the issue of the transformational approach in the judiciary branch. Of course, transformation in the true sense of the word does not happen in a year or two, but the beginning of this movement in the judiciary and the adoption of this orientation and this approach was very important. It must continue, it must not stop, rather it must intensify. Naturally, if you start a movement and if you want it to produce the desired results, then not only should the movement not see a hiatus in the middle of the way, but it should also intensify and be strengthened so that it can reach the final destination.
Around the world with reporters.
After 2 months of digging into a depth of more than 20 meters, Yemen's Mine Action Center managed to defuse one of the largest U.S. bombs dropped in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. The bomb was expected to target the civil defense building in Sana'a.
This GBU-24 bomb from the Paveway series was dropped in 2015 to target the civilian defense building in Sana'a next to Al Thara Park and Al Hasaba local market. The Saudi-led coalition has been using various types of advanced American weapons in its war on Yemen. This is a clear violation of the international humanitarian law.
Observers say this bomb is another proof of the U.S. military support for the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen.
We defused a GBU-24 bomb with a weigh of 1.5 tons. The bomb targeted this hangar designated for the maintenance of Yemeni civil defensive fire trucks. The explosion of the bomb could have caused a humanitarian catastrophe with great consequences. The U.S. has provided only a few countries, including Saudi Arabia, with such a bomb.
Over the past years, Saudi Arabia has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. bombs, to target residential areas across the country. Back in April 2015, Riyadh committed one unforgettable crime by bombing the Attan area with a U.S. cluster bomb, killing more than 100 civilians, including women and the children.
This American bomb dropped by U.S. aircraft is yet another witness to Washington's role in the war crimes in Yemen, as the U.N. turns a blind eye to such violations. Besides the military support, Yemenis say Washington has always been backing Saudi Arabia politically as a major ally in the region. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Security situation is deteriorating day by day in Afghanistan due to the rising Taliban attacks, mainly on key cities and districts across the country. In an assault launched on Saturday, most of the suburbs of Ghazni city in southern Afghanistan came under Taliban control.
The attack pushed back Afghan forces into the city as they struggled to avoid the collapse of the strategic area, which is located very close to Kabul-Herat highway.
Officials in Ghazni say Afghan security forces are strongly resisting in the city, noting that dozens of Taliban militants, including foreign nationals, have been killed as a result of counter-attack operations by Afghan security forces.
The enemy has captured some areas in the suburbs of the city. This is because we tactically retreated from those areas. They also made efforts to enter the city, but we pounded them hard and pushed back the terrorists from the city.
This comes as thousands of locals have also stood alongside the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces to resist against the Taliban, a move which has been supported by influential figures and locals in Afghanistan.
Our great nation has always proved to be alongside the country's national security and defense forces. Our people will once again resist against the Taliban now that the militant group wants to expand its military grip.
Apart from consequences like rising violence and bloodshed in Afghanistan, tens of thousands of local Afghans have so far been displaced inside the country. In such circumstances, Menaher urged both the Afghan government and the Taliban to rather focus on political solutions to resolve their difference than engaging in a deadly conflict. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Scores of Palestinian fishermen staged a protest against the ongoing Israeli violations against them in the Sea of Gaza. The Israeli siege imposed on the fishing area for 15 years has deteriorated the lives of Gazan fishermen who are dependent on the fishing industry and has badly affected Gaza's economy.
The raw materials required for repairing our nets and boats are not allowed to enter Gaza. This has deteriorated the condition of most fishermen in Gaza. For 15 years, the Israeli regime has intended to close down fishing zones in fishing seasons.
The fishermen syndicate in Gaza organized a protest in Gaza's port. There was also a press conference aimed at highlighting the Israeli abuse against fishermen, namely opening fire at them, arresting them, and droning fishing boats.
I lost my brothers and I lost my money and my source of income as the Israeli regime bombed my boat in 2014. And here I am, participating in this protest while human rights groups turn a blind eye to what is happening to us.
During the latest Israeli offensive on Gaza, Israel closed the sea completely. Since the end of the onslaught on 21st May, Israel has opened the sea for fishermen only for 6 miles, which is not enough for fishermen to get enough fish to help them make money or even provide enough fish for consumers.
The inhumane Israeli blockade has restricted our work for 15 years now. Most of fishermen now lack fishing nets and equipment due to the closure of borders. The Israeli regime is trying to destroy the Palestinian income by any means. The occupiers intend to make us isolated and restrict our daily work.
Under the Oslo Agreement, the fishing range was 20 miles. However, over the years, the Israeli military gradually reduced this range, severely damaging the livelihoods of thousands of fishermen. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is worsening due to the Israeli blockade, which is taking its toll on the life of 2 million Palestinians. Fishermen here in Gaza call on the international community to pressurize Israel to end these restrictions that threaten their daily lives and make it hard to maintain any source of income. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war against Yemen in 2015, thousands of Yemenis, including businessmen, have been forcibly displaced from Saudi territories due to their sympathy with their country. Others have been imprisoned and tortured on charges of being Houthis.
The Saudi authorities practice various types of violations against Yemenis residing in the kingdom. The number of forcibly displaced people from Saudi Arabia, according to the International Organization for Migration, has reached more than 49,000. Saudi Arabia began practicing enforced disappearance and torture of Yemenis because of their sympathy with the countrymen since the beginning of war. This is considered a clear violation of the international humanitarian law.
Abdul Latif al-Hashimi is one of those displaced from Saudi Arabia. He has established a foundation in Sana'a to expose the Saudi practices against Yemenis and to help those who feel alienated upon their arrival in Yemen after spending decades of their lives in Saudi Arabia. Al-Hashimi says some Yemenis have been displaced or imprisoned because of their last name if it refers to a Hashimi family.
There are Yemenis imprisoned in Saudi Arabia on charges of being Houthis belonging to a particular sect or because of their last name if it refers to Hashemite family. Even those who show sympathy with their countrymen suffering from the Saudi war and blockade are imprisoned. Others have their money and trade confiscated. We seek to help those who are deported to Yemen, as most of them feel alienated upon their return to Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. The brutal war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children.
The grievance of forcibly displaced Yemenis from Saudi Arabia exposes another aspect of Riyadh's violations of the humanitarian law. People here say all this comes amid